Files and formats. Introduction. Web development is a lot of fumbling around with files. Yes, you'll be coding, but you'll become very familiar with various kinds of files and how they may be very quickly copied, moved, accessed, and edited. What constitutes a file, and exactly how to interact with one, is dependent upon the operating system you're using. That said, modern operating systems have pretty similar ideas about files. Files are a means of storing data in some medium, either permanently or temporarily. It's typical to store a file on a physical medium, such as some kind of disk or solid-state drive, but it's also normal to create files in memory that are only meant to assist with the running of a particular program and which are then deleted when the program is finished running. In routine web development, you'll be dealing with the more permanent kind. File naming conventions. There are many different kinds of files you're going to encounter in web development. It's deeply tedious and time-consuming if you have to open a file in order to discern its contents or purpose. For this reason, there are file naming conventions that make it easier for a web developer to know what a file is for. There are also very common conventions for creating directory or folder structures so that every file has a correct location. We'll cover folders and hierarchies in the next lesson. File extensions. Probably the most common file naming convention you'll encounter is the file extension. You probably already know what a file extension is. Indeed, you've seen them in this course. But to be clear, let's define a file extension as a file name suffix that begins with a period or dot and which is then followed by a few characters which identify the file's type. File extensions aren't strictly necessary, but they're very useful. Modern operating systems don't require file extensions, but you'll find that file extensions are very useful for working with files. Because, by convention, they instantly identify a file's type, they can help web developers decide where a file should go in a file hierarchy or which program should be used to open the file for inspection or editing. Operating systems typically keep track of the programs that are associated with a given file extension, too. This makes possible, for example, double-clicking a file and opening it with the correct program by default. Here's a list of the typical file extensions you'll encounter in a modern website. Some of these file types will be already familiar and some won't. Don't worry about that. Just take a look and get accustomed to a few names. And there are many more. It's precisely because there are so many different kinds of files used in web development that file extensions are so helpful. But you don't need to be familiar with every kind of file extension. The main point here is not to be afraid of a new extension. It's a quick task to do a search for an unfamiliar extension. File naming guidelines. As far as naming files goes, beyond file extensions, you'll have some latitude. That said, there are some good rules to keep in mind, which have been developed over years of practice and refinement. No spaces. It's best to avoid spaces in file names. Of course, it's possible to use spaces in file names, and it's a pretty standard practice to do so when working with various types of documents in a business, educational, or casual context. But developers tend to avoid this practice. Spaces need to be escaped when file names are typed into a command line interface or as part of a URL. Escaping is the usage of a special character sequence in order to type a single special character. For example, because a space on a command line would normally indicate the end of one command or parameter and the beginning of another, one way of indicating that a space is part of a file name is to use a backslash, like so. The escape sequence can be interpreted as a single space in an overall file name. Does this seem awkward? That's because it is. Don't do it, or some senior developer who happens to be your boss at your first job is going to ask you why you're making her life difficult. And then she's going to make your life difficult. Instead of spaces, use hyphens or underscores instead. Avoid special characters. Special characters include the following. Also included are any other characters that require special key sequences to type, or which might be operating system specific, like the command symbol on Mac OS machines. These kinds of characters very often have special meanings depending upon the context they're being used in. For this reason, do not use them. However tempting they might seem, special characters have the potential to create more trouble than they're worth, and it's a standard practice for developers to avoid them. This goes for, you guessed it, emoji characters too. Standardize your naming format. Settle on a format and use it. Different programming languages and frameworks will have their own conventions for naming files, and you should absolutely follow them. Doing so will make it easier to locate files when you come back to a project after having not seen it for 6 months or longer. A good default format is as follows. Use all lowercase characters. Numbers are fine, but it's best not to start a file name with one. Use hyphens or underscores instead of spaces. Always use an appropriate file extension. Use the same file extension for the same type of file, even if multiple file extensions are available. For example, image1.jpg and image2.jpg, or image1.jpg and image2.jpg, but don't mix them up. Keep file names as short as is reasonably possible. Don't use dates in file names. This creates a possible maintenance issue and can possibly affect SEO. Again, some frameworks or languages will have their own file naming schemes, and older projects might have established ways of handling this too. Whatever the format is, learn it and use it in order to make your files maintainable down the road. Folders and paths. Folders serve as containers. Folders function as containers for files. Almost every idea related to computers has some complication and depth, and folders are no exception. But most of the time, this is what we're thinking about when we think of folders. For our purpose, the terms directory and folder are synonymous. The term folder is more often used with graphical interfaces, but you'll hear it used in other contexts too. It's normal for folders to contain both files and more folders. A folder will often contain many additional folders, each with additional files and folders of their own. Folders contained within other folders are called subfolders or subdirectories. A directory located one level up from your current location is called a parent directory. The directory at the top of a drive's overall hierarchy is called the root directory. The top-level directory of a website is also often referred to as the site's root directory. This is usually not the root directory of the drive that the site is hosted on, but it's convenient to refer to a site's top-level folder as the root. Paths mark the way to a file. As you work on a site, you'll open folders, access files, move into different subdirectories, and so on. If you make a list of the subdirectories you need to access in order to find a file, beginning at the site's root, and then add the file name to that list, you'll have what's called the file's path. Let's take a look. Here's an example of a newly generated directory tree for what will become a blog. A directory tree is the top-level directory with levels of all of the subdirectories below the top level. We see a few different kinds of files here, including a few that might be new to you. What we're interested in is the structure here. See that little blue dot at the top of the figure? A single period or dot is the usual way to indicate the directory you're currently in. You can specify a parent directory, going up a directory, by using two periods. So if we were working in the underscore posts subdirectory, and we want to use Linux's cp command to copy the about.md file into the underscore posts subdirectory, we could write this command. As long as we're working on a Linux or macOS command line, this command will go up a directory from where we are, underscore posts, find the about.md file there, and then copy it to our current directory. Our root directory contains six files and a subdirectory, underscore posts. The underscore posts subdirectory contains one file, so from the root directory, we can say that the path to the file in the underscore posts subdirectory is this. This is a normal path designation for Linux and macOS systems. They use slashes to specify paths. When using the Windows operating system, backslashes are used to specify paths, like so. Slashes and backslashes aren't interchangeable, though. You'll need to use the operating system's designated path separator when you're typing a path on a command line. The path separator is the character used to separate directories in a path. Slashes and backslashes are most common. Paths in URLs. Paths are also used in URLs to specify resources. There are three kinds of paths that are used: absolute, relative, site root relative. An absolute path specifies the location of a resource with the entire URL required to locate that resource. Let's take a look at another example of a pretty typical website directory. Here we have the usual suspects. There's an index.html file, which is usually configured to be the first page seen when anyone visits a website. There's also an about page. There are some posts in a subdirectory, another public subdirectory where the site's assets are kept, and a templates subdirectory for the layout templates. Based on this directory structure, we can assume there will be some kind of program that combines the HTML in the posts with the layout HTML in the templates and generates a final site somewhere. Creating paths. Now let's look at a few ways to create links using the three different kinds of paths. Let's say you're working in first-post.html and you want to link to the logo.png image. One way to do that would be to include a link with a relative path. This is called a relative path because the logo.png is specified relative to the first-post.html's location in the site. From the first-post.html file, we go up a directory, then go into the public directory, then images, and then find our resource. A site root relative path is going to be similar. The main difference is that instead of linking from the document's location, the link begins with a slash that represents the site's root. So if we use this style of path in our link, this is what we get. Yep, those links are equivalent. The main thing to remember is that in the relative path, we're beginning at the document's location, and with the site relative root path, the beginning slash is always present and represents the site's root directory. Finally, we have absolute paths. An absolute path specifies a resource by providing a complete URL to the resource, including the protocol. So if we were to link with an absolute path, this is what we do. If you're linking to a resource located on another server, this is probably the method you'll have to use. Also, absolute paths are better for SEO, because you must specify the whole address. However, absolute paths will be possibly difficult to work with if you're using a staging or development server. For development, relative paths or site root relative paths are going to be easier to work with. Site layout guidelines. As far as a site's layout goes, and where to put the files you'll be linking to, there are a few guidelines to keep in mind. Don't put everything in one directory. Even for small sites, it might be tempting, but don't do it. You don't want to open up a site's directory and find a mass of files of different types. Files accumulate quickly in web development, and they need to be organized for the sake of maintainability and developer sanity. Always remember, too, that you might not be the only one working on a website. Organization is key. Think carefully about your site's purpose and meaning. With organization in mind, think very carefully about what a file is meant to do. Certain files, like images and scripts, belong in their own directories, and they might need to be further organized into different subdirectories depending upon how large a site is and how complicated the code gets. Otherwise, organize HTML or other markup files according to purpose. If you're creating a blog, it makes sense to have a posts subdirectory. If you're going to be showcasing products, then a product subdirectory is sensible. Don't forget about SEO and your users. Try to create paths that make sense. Your paths will often appear in your site's URLs. Including keywords in your URL paths is a good practice, so it's smart to name directories in meaningful ways. Don't get crazy with this idea, because that can be off-putting to say the least. But something meaningful and helpful can be a nice feature of the site. With these ideas in mind, let's look at our previous example of a good hierarchy for a blog. Everything has its place. Our root level pages are general. The index.html page is our starting point, and the about page is loosely categorized and easy to find. The posts are all in their own directory. The publicly accessible assets are all nicely stowed away, and no developer, either yourself, in the future, or someone else, will have trouble understanding where they are or why they're here. The templates are easy to locate, and the organization is functional. There are, of course, other ways to do this, and frameworks like Node's Express, or Ruby on Rails, or Python's Django will have their own structures. Depending upon the framework, this structure can be altered, but is sometimes difficult to do and is only changed when absolutely necessary. If a framework has a convention, even if it's not initially obvious, there's usually a reason. At the end of the day, go with what's reasonable, smart, and well-organized, but don't put everything into one directory. Transfer tools and methods. Files are fine and dandy, but how do you transfer them to your web server? After you've created all the files on your own development machine, do you open up each file individually and copy it by retyping it carefully, one file at a time, into a terminal that accesses your server? No. Can you honestly imagine how awful that would be? One thing, though, fast and accurate typists would make a lot of money copying files. Alas, fast and accurate typists will have to use their skills elsewhere because there is a better way. But first, let's take a look at a tool that's fallen out of favor. File Transfer Protocol. File Transfer Protocol, or FTP, is an old-school approach to file transfer that dates all the way back to the 1970s. For a while, FTP was a preferred method of handling web server file transfers. FTP programs, called FTP clients, were often included with many operating systems, and they were available in either command line or GUI formats. An example of a command line session on an FTP server looked something like this. Here we see an example FTP session that connects to a server named example. You can see that at the FTP prompts, the user can type commands and receive informative responses. In this example, we see the put command used to transfer a single file. The mput command did the same thing but could transfer multiple files. One of the basic problems with FTP, and there are others but this is a big one, is that passwords were entered and then transferred in clear text for authentication. Clear text is unencrypted, easily read text. Someone could intercept the traffic between the web server and the FTP client, and more quickly than you can say, "Where are all my files?" they could have your unencrypted, ready-to-use password. This is called a sniffing attack, and this is not fun. Secure Shell File Transfer Protocol. SFTP to the rescue. This is currently one of the preferred methods of transferring files, and one you'll likely become very familiar with. SFTP, SSH File Transfer Protocol, is similar to FTP in some ways, but much better, because SFTP uses SSH Secure Shell Protocol to conduct all data transfers over an encrypted connection. Sniffers can still sniff, and they can even catch a whiff, but the encryption is the difference. You get the idea. In order to use SFTP, you can either work with the command line SFTP program, or you can use a graphical client. There are many free graphical clients available for all major operating systems, and they vary only a little in how they're used. Generally, you'll set up a new server by providing a few details: your username, the server's IP address, a password, and then you'll be able to connect. Each graphical client will have its own documentation. To find one for your operating system, just do an online search for free SFTP client for your OS here, and you'll see the most popular options pop up. Alternatively, you can use the command line tool. A typical SFTP session will begin by typing the program's name, followed by a username host string that looks similar to an email address. If you've set up SSH keys, how to do this is beyond the scope of this lesson, but there are many tutorials online, which partly involves a file that resides on your own computer and contains an encrypted string or key, then the SSH program will use that key to identify itself to the remote server, or example.com in this case. If you haven't set up SSH keys, then you'll be prompted for the password that pairs with the username specified, in this case, admin. After you're successfully authenticated, you'll be dropped into a prompt similar to the FTP prompt, and you'll be able to enter commands. Much of the time, you'll be opting for a graphical client, which is more pleasant if you're not accustomed to command line tools. Eventually, you might find that the command line is more efficient, however. Generally, the less pointing and clicking you have to do, the better. rsync. rsync is a handy little program for your toolkit. rsync synchronizes directories, making sure that when one file changes in one, the changes, and only those parts of the files that have changed, are copied over to the other directory. Restricting the copies to only the changes minimizes the data transfer and makes the updates more efficient. Syncing two directories is as simple as typing the following command. The dash A in the command is an option that tells rsync to preserve all file attributes when transferring changes from dir-a to dir-b. There are other options, too, for enabling data compression when transferring or making a progress bar show up to indicate syncing status and so on. The slash after dir-a is necessary in order to tell rsync to copy the contents of dir-a and not all of dir-a. The example syncs two local directories, which wouldn't be very useful for web development, but rsync works with SSH in order to accomplish remote syncing too. Note, rsync is a Unix-based tool, so you'll need to be running Linux or macOS or Unix in order to use it. That said, there are rsync clones and rsync-like tools available for Windows. Git. Git is a version control system, and strictly speaking, wasn't exactly designed to be a substitute for SFTP or rsync or some other file transfer tool. What is version control? Version control systems, also called SCMs for source code management, are extremely important in software development, and we'll be looking at Git more closely. An SCM keeps track of changes in source code files and allows any developer working on a project to check out the latest version of a file or any version of the file that's been saved in the SCM in the past. If two developers are working on the same file and they both commit changes in that file to the SCM, and if those changes conflict, then the SCM will help the developers to resolve the conflicts too. A good SCM will do all of this and much more, even for development teams that are distributed all over the world. One other thing an SCM will do, it will pull the entire latest version of a project to a server. This sounds as though SCMs are powerful pieces of software, and this is very true. There are a variety of SCMs available. But right now, Git is the most popular. It's free, open source, the source code can be checked out by anyone, extremely powerful, relatively easy to learn, and has a very large community. With Git, it's possible to set up a strategy that will allow you to edit your code, track all changes, coordinate with other developers and designers as necessary, and push all your changes to a code repository that can be pulled from automatically by a production server. Data transfer principles. Not sure which file transfer tool to use? Here are some principles to keep in mind. Keep it simple. Some of the options described in this unit might seem complicated. The ideas here are pretty quickly explored, and at least some of them are new to you, so their novelty might present a challenge. Truthfully, the tools discussed here are all pretty simple, and that's good. As your skills grow, the sites and applications you work on can become rather complex, and project deployment can become a little involved. Try to keep things as simple as possible, even if the definition of simple changes as you become more comfortable with your skill set. Keep it safe. Whenever you're copying files over to where other files are living peacefully, be careful about overwriting existing files and losing data. This is especially a concern with SFTP, which will allow you to overwrite files. But if you're not careful, one mistake could mean, boom, the code you've been painstakingly refining for the last 3 hours just got clobbered. To avoid this catastrophe, back up everything before you copy files to a server. Double-check your setup and be absolutely certain that what you're about to copy is meant to be copied. If you're going to use Git or rsync, then you're better off because these programs, especially Git, will make it harder for you to lose changes you've made. Still, it's very good to become paranoid about data loss. Keep it secure. SFTP, rsync, and Git are all secure when properly configured. Prefer these methods over all others. In general, it's best to take security very seriously, even if you've never encountered a serious security breach before, or you think that no one will be really interested in your data or your site in general. This is simply not true. Asking any system administrator about their log files and security setup will usually get you into a pretty energetic discussion about the last time someone tried to break through their security. Security threats and breaches happen every single day, and often on sites that wouldn't seem like they would attract attackers. The world we live in is often an aggressive, opportunistic place, and it's a good idea to protect your servers and your code as though this is the case. Knowledge check. Test your knowledge of new information by answering these questions and then review the feedback. Question 1. Which of these is not an advantage of using a version control system? Option 1. It will make a website more secure. Correct. Version control can do many things, but it won't make a website more secure. Option 2. It allows several people to work on a project at the same time. Incorrect. A version control system makes it possible for multiple people to work on the same program at once. Option 3. If a mistake is discovered, the program can be rolled back to how it used to be before the error was introduced. Incorrect. This is one of the most important features of a version control system. Option 4. It will help reconcile conflicting copies of a program. Incorrect. This is a great advantage when multiple people are working on the same program at the same time. Question 2. Which of these would make the best file name? Option 1. JMS.doc. Incorrect. It's really hard to determine what is in this file without opening it. That can be a hassle when you are trying to find a file. Option 2. JMS$salary.doc. Incorrect. Special characters should be avoided in file names because they can cause problems down the line. Option 3. JMS_salary.doc. Correct. That's a good file name. It lets the user know that it contains their salary data. Option 4. JMSS.doc. Incorrect. What's in this file? It's really hard to know without going through the trouble of opening it. Question 3. A folder can be compared to a... Option 1. Shopping cart. Incorrect. A shopping cart is not a good analogy for a folder because a shopping cart is mostly for moving items. Option 2. Elevator. Incorrect. An elevator is not a good analogy for a folder because the primary purpose of a folder is not to move things. Option 3. Storage box. Correct. A storage box is a good analogy because folders are used to store files. Option 4. Conversation. Incorrect. A conversation is not the best analogy because folders are not primarily used to convey information back and forth. Conclusion. When you're a web developer, files are your livelihood. Your code lives in files. Your site's assets are a bunch of files. And your client's data is stored in files. Files, 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 and folders. Becoming proficient at dealing with these artifacts is necessary and will happen pretty naturally, but proficiency implies a mindset as well as technical understanding and tools. Where mindset is concerned, be aware that data loss is always at risk. Someone's always trying to steal your data, and the only thing preventing worldwide disaster, or at least a really, really bad day at work, is your personal brand of technical kung fu. Learn your tools well. Read the available documentation, even if it seems like a slog at first, and the work will absolutely pay off. You'd be surprised at how the difference between an okay developer and a master is sometimes just about who's really read the documentation and has the right attitude.